This episode of Social Flight Live is made possible by Avemco Insurance. Mention Social Flight for a 5% insurance discount at Avemco.com, subject to terms and conditions.
Welcome to the Social Flight Live podcast, an audio version of our live show, hosted every Tuesday evening at 8 p.m. Eastern at SocialFlightLive.com. Social Flight is brought to you by Aspen Avionics, Avidyne, Continental Aerospace Technologies, Lightspeed Aviation, Tempest Aero Group, and Whip Air. And now, here's your host, Jeff Simon.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Social Flight Live. I'm Jeff Simon. We have a fantastic show for you this evening and very educational. Colonel Justin Astro Elliott, Division Chief for NORAD's Current Operations Division at Peterson Space Force Base in Colorado, is here. We are going to talk about his unbelievable background. We're going to go inside NORAD and their mission, talk about the real story behind what you hear in the news, but most importantly, learn quite a bit about what is going on right now having to do with TFRs, things that you need to know as pilots and aviation enthusiasts about that. And so it's really going to be an impressive show. Let's get started as soon as possible. And I just want to do a couple quick things as we are now ending summer after Labor Day weekend. Hopefully you had a fantastic weekend there and got in some good flying. Well, we've now got all of our fall events just kicking off in Social Flight. I'm seeing so many cool things get added. We've got pumpkin fly-ins and Halloween events already in there, all sorts of things as we start to see people scheduling their events for the holidays, you name it. So go check out socialflight.com and the free mobile apps for Apple and Android devices. Just type in one word with no space, Social Flight. It'll get you everything that you need to do in order to check all of that out. In addition to that, we've got our FAA learning system inside Social Flight. You can go and inside of that be able to see a ton of all of the courses that you can take for wings credit. You can, if you're a mechanic, you can get all sorts of courses for that, for your aviation maintenance technician awards program, as well as being able to, if you're an IA, get your renewal, your 8 hours of recurring education, all there. And lastly, we've got our Fly to Win Challenge where we're always giving away prizes. We just gave away an Aspen E5 electronic flight instrument. Our winner was Jody Earhart from Justin, Texas. And we're now giving away a Lightspeed Delta Zulu headset on October 1st. All you need to do is get the Social Flight mobile app and check in at your local airport. Even one check-in gets you entered into the drawing. But if you do a bunch of airports, get a bunch of points, you can get additional entries in that drawing if you get on our leaderboard. Now, tonight's broadcast is brought to you by Avidyne and the amazing IFD 550, 540, and 440 series of navigators and the newly certified Avidyne Vantage system that is literally transforming the cockpits of panels of Cirrus aircraft. It is truly, truly amazing. You should definitely check that out. We've got the IF 550 and 440 in our Bonanza that we use. And in this aircraft behind me here, we have, looks like my screen has frozen. Let me go and restart that. Okay. So what I was just saying is that in this screen behind me, we have our actual 550 that's going in our Titan Mustang. And so that's there as well. And with that, I'd like to kick off our show. And if we could get a couple of people here chiming in and just let us know that everything's good. Gotcha. All right. So let's get started. Colonel Justin Astro Elliott is Division Chief for NORAD's Current Operations Division at Peterson Space Force Base in Colorado. He supervises 80 operators from 9 military branches across the United States and Canada through the execution of NORAD's primary mission of defending the homelands. Colonel Elliott and his team track, report, and mitigate all air, missile, and maritime activity approaching North America, creating a global threat picture and a posture of national leadership for both the United States and Canada to respond swiftly to for challenges both locally and abroad. But his background is something truly, truly to sit back and just soak in. He entered the Air Force in 2005 with a ROTC commission from Yale University and began his flying career on the F-15E and F-35 as an instructor pilot and evaluator. After serving as a weapons instructor, and after attending the U.S. Air Force Weapons School, which is the Air Force's version of Top Gun that people are so familiar with, he served as the weapons instructor and operational test pilot for the 422nd Test and Evaluation Squadron at Nellis Air Force Base in Nevada. His test pilot's credits include all six Air Force fighters, and that includes the F-35, the F-22, the F-15EX, the F-15E, the F-16, and the A-10. And if that weren't enough, Colonel Elliott subsequently served as commander of the United States Air Force Thunderbirds. As Thunderbird 1, Colonel Elliott led the Air Force Demonstration Squadron through 150 air shows across 70 United States and international cities while flying his F-16s mere inches apart at speeds greater than 600 miles per hour. So buckle up, we're going to cover an awful lot tonight. Please welcome to Social Flight Live, Colonel Justin Astro Elliott. How are you doing, sir?
Good, Jeff. Thanks for having me on the show. Excited to meet you all.
Hey, thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule to join us here. I mean, man, oh man, that is a resume that where do you even begin? And yet I want to begin at the start. What is it that kicked you off on this journey that ended up covering so much ground that I just described?
Yeah, Jeff, it's a good question. Not what you would expect, perhaps. So I grew up in Houston, Texas, and what I was surrounded by, for aviation influence was NASA's Astronaut Corps. You know, having manned space flight right there in your town and visiting Johnson Space Center and getting to see the space life, right? That was what really got me interested. And you know, for me, I had seen aviation, I had seen air shows, but my parents, they immigrated from Canada. So, you know, my parents didn't really know how to guide me in that direction. So I remember doing my own research and finding out that, hey, these NASA astronauts, most of them are Air Force test pilots or Navy test pilots. So I guess if I want to go to space, I have to do that. And that's what got me started down the road of aviation. I started mowing lawns at airfields and trying to bum flight hours off of Weiser Airfield in Houston, Texas, and getting, you know, my first couple of flight hours. I remember my parents were pretty upset about this, but I was determined to solo an airplane before I drove a car. I made that happen when I was 16. And all of this kind of led to this path towards science and engineering as I approached college. And I'll tell you, Jeff, there's a twist in this story, because as I got to that college experience, I went in ROTC because I really did have this dream of flying for the Air Force and eventually chasing that space dream. But I had pretty bad vision, bad enough that I was not qualified to be an Air Force pilot. So when I took that ROTC scholarship and went to college for engineering, I went knowing that I was not going to be able to do this, that I was going to end up an engineer. And I even considered law and some alternate path within the military. And sometimes you just get lucky. You chase something hard enough that you're there and ready, and the opportunity presents itself with a policy change. And that's what happened for me. So the Air Force changed its policy in February 2003 to allow laser surgery for the first time. And in March of 2003, I got laser surgery. And in April of 2003, I was on the pilot selection board to go into the Air Force. And so that's where it started. A lot of luck involved in that story.
No kidding. That's fantastic. But I mean, you had to have been already like absolute ace, top of your class. I mean, you don't just slide Yale in there as your starting point for ROTC without something that came before it.
Yeah. So for me, I think for kids that are looking to go to an Ivy League or a military academy, they're extremely competitive, and that's well known. And I think it's important to have something that you identify with that sets yourself apart on those thousands of applications that go towards those universities. So for me, flying was a huge part of that identity. It was unique. It was something that I had kind of pursued on my own. I was also a swimmer at the national level. I had a top 16 time in the 200 breaststroke. And so that made me competitive to swim for the university, which certainly helped. And then academically, you can't be a slouch, but I wasn't a genius or anything. You know, I was kind of a pretty good high school student, but with those extra things that were identifying parts of me, it was enough to get me over the line and get into Yale.
So tell me a little bit about your Air Force career. that, I mean, you clearly ended up moving in a direction that took you towards not just instructor pilot and evaluator, but eventually into actually test pilot, which is in itself, you can put the end of the bio right there, and it's incredibly impressive. Tell me a little bit about that path.
You know, it's funny. When you join the Air Force in your early years, it is very much about your aspirational goals, whatever those are. And you know, you enter the Air Force with these ideas. And I'll reemphasize that for me, that idea was space flight. And so I knew that I had to find a way to test pilot school within my Air Force life. And that was what I went in with. Things changed. And as I got into my first combat squadron, flying the F-15E out of Seymour. I started to run into leaders in the Air Force, squadron commanders, weapons officers. Those are graduates from weapons school, which, as you mentioned, is our version of Top Gun, a little bit less volleyball. And you know, you are influenced by those around you, right? And the caliber of people that I was meeting in these fighter squadrons as weapons officers and commanders were so humbling, so unbelievably inspiring that I started really feeling like I had a fork in the road. You know, do I pursue this test pilot goal, which would take me down an experimental path and ultimately potentially to space? Or do I pursue what I'm now seeing, these inspirational weapons instructors and squadron commanders, and kind of pursue that leadership role? And it felt like an impossible decision to make. So I kind of did both. So I continued to chase the education piece of it, to get a master's in aerospace engineering. To keep the door open for test flight. And then I also became an instructor in the F-15E to keep the door open for weapons school. And I was very fortunate to run into a commander named Gipper Bunch, who first introduced the idea to me that maybe, just maybe, although fairly unprecedented, you could do both. If you went to weapons school early enough in your career, you may just have a chance to shift over and do test pilot school later. No one was really sure what that path was going to look like, but it was appealing enough to give it a shot. So I focused on going to weapons school first, finished that, served as a weapons instructor for a few years, and then got into test pilot school using the education side of it that I was kind of pursuing on the side. And I think that's important for anyone who's looking to do that. You do need that education piece. It's not optional, and it's not something you can just grab quickly when you want to apply to test pilot school. So that background matters.
So did you tell me a little bit about your selection for becoming a patch to being able to get to weapon school?
It's tough. It's really tough. You have to be a really solid instructor, you know, much like you see in the intro credits of Top Gun. You know, they're looking for your top 1% instructor fighter pilots that already are master instructors in their aircraft, that know the jet inside out and the tactics. And when you're selected for it, they're informal, but it's a flying evaluation that they put you through, where you go out and guest help with the weapons school as a wingman. And what they're really looking for is your attitude and your ability to adapt to an environment that complex. And I got fortunate enough to get into weapons school, and I was not disappointed with that curriculum. It is unbelievable. And I think most of us would call it a leadership course in disguise as a tactics course, because they're going to give you unsolvable problems for 6 months, and they expect you to figure out how to solve them. Some of them are open-ended. They don't even have answers, much like real combat is going to be when you're managing 100 jets, you know, from bombers to surveillance to fighters to everything in between. You know, you're going to have uncertainty. The other thing I'll point out about the weapons school is its motto is be humble, be approachable, be credible, which is something that I have hung on to for the 13 years since graduating.
That's a really good point. And my understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, is that one of the, we think of weapons school graduates, people that the patch wearers that are the creme of the creme tactical fighters pilots, actually stick and rudder and tactics folks. And yet, I think what I've gathered is that the real purpose of the program is actually to create those educators to take that knowledge out to the front line and become the leaders in the field and disseminate that, because you can't put everyone through it. And so it seems to be about education.
That's exactly right. And I would say it is Above all, I remember the commandant opening the course by saying, "Hey, after today, it is not about you anymore. You are out there to make more of you, to make those expert instructor pilots and to teach them to think outside the box and to lead with humility and credibility," which is why the course does put you through the creme de la creme combat challenges that make you a really good pilot, because to be a great instructor, you have to have the credibility to back that up. You know, if you've got somebody who's outperforming you in your squadron, you need to be humble enough to encourage that, but also be credible enough to be like, "Hey, there are a few things I can show you, bud," and be able to back that up.
It, when you when you reintegrate back into your deployment or wherever you are after weapons school, how does that balance work where you're coming back with all this knowledge and an asset to your essentially your team, and there's a leadership structure there as well? How does that work?
That's an excellent question. Wow, Jeff, you really got to it. That's a real thing, and it's important that young weapons officers understand that balance, because you are the absolute best you're ever going to be in a fighter jet right at that moment when you graduate from weapons school. And you need to know, though, that you're not the commander of the squadron. Vice versa, the commander is not the weapons officer in the squadron. I think those roles need to be established very clearly. The leader of the squadron is there to take care of people and to set direction and guidance and drive the squadron in the correct direction. The weapons officer is there to take that direction and guidance and create the team that the commander needs to execute that vector. It's two different roles, and when they come together, it's not great. So
But when it's well balanced, it's the whole key to our military defense. Absolutely. And so that theme of education and communication seems to lend itself extremely well to test pilot. To being a test pilot as well. So tell me a little bit about that, because I think a lot of people, when they think about being a test pilot, they again think stick and rudder. They again think about, going out there and trying a new aircraft and risk and things like that. And my understanding in that side is it's so much science and engineering and understanding that and being able to communicate to the folks who actually have to make changes to the aircraft.
I think sometimes you might be reading my mind, Jeff. So
Hey, if you're gonna send out compliments, I'm gonna soak it in from someone like you, but go, please.
you're absolutely right. You know, both weapons school and test pilot school are ultimately flying courses. That's the vessel through which they convey the desired learning objectives. But if I were to break it down, weapons school is a leadership course. Test pilot school is an education course. It is exactly what you said. You have to understand everything from blimps to helicopters to large airplanes to the reasons behind flight design and flight control law. And you're not going to be the master in any one aircraft when you graduate from test pilot school, but you're expected to be able to translate all of it. I mean, you are, as a test pilot, there's so few. You know, they graduate approximately 7 to 10 fighter test pilots in a year from Air Force Test Pilot School. Very, very small numbers. And you are the translator between the engineers and the designers of the aircraft to the users who are looking for a certain combat capability. And you're expected to validate the specifications that they ask for, but also take that leap and say, "Hey, you may not have asked for this, but this machine can do this, and that may be a good thing in combat." And so it's a daunting role, and not one that I think most of us enter understanding. A lot of test pilot graduates become more and more encouraged by what that education gave them as they grow up. And as an example, I'll give you know, you're only a military test pilot for so long, because realistically, you're going to graduate test pilot school at year 10 to 11. It's not, you don't have a ton of career left. But those same graduates are the ones that go on to test for Boeing or Lockheed or Northrop or the FAA. And so all that education and background that may not be useful on your first military assignment, it is very useful when you're flying an X-plane for the first time for one of these companies, whether that be a large airplane or a small fighter.
And what was the aircraft that you were on as your kind of graduating project from test pilot school?
I was when I was graduating from test pilot school, while I was still in the course, I was actually working on the human physiology issues that were plaguing fighter pilots with the breathing issues. And so a lot of that graduation course was spent in an F-16 with an over-restricted pressure vest and a pinched off hose, trying to replicate the unexplained physiological episodes. And then this is a fun one for everybody. We spent multiple weeks doing 3 turns a day in the centrifuge, just trying to make ourselves feel as terrible as possible, and then taking cognitive tests. So that was my graduation project. Welcome to experimental flight test.
Yeah, you're the experiment.
That's exactly right. The jet I worked on right after that was the F-15 Community, which was F-15Cs, F-15Es, and then the new Advanced Eagle was just coming online when I was a new test pilot. So I flew that little bit as it was developing into the EX.
So you obviously went on to a whole bunch of different aircraft, et cetera, but then you wound up with the Thunderbirds. Mm-hmm. Tell me how that happened.
That was not the plan, Jeff. So so I had a plan. I had a plan, you know, as it's the same plan that I had in, you know, 2001 when I went into ROTC. So I had kind of made it, right? Like I was graduated weapons instructor. I was graduated test pilot. I checked all the boxes. I was a graduated squadron commander, in fact, of a really great fighter squadron out of Nellis called the 59th, where I had all 6 jets. I had 10 of each jet. Kind of the dream, right? And so I was done with squadron command. That box was checked. I was, you know, ready to move forward. And for me, I was in the middle of a NASA application to astronaut at that time. And I had been a finalist 4 years before. So, you know, when I was a little bit too young to make it into the Corps, I was an astronaut finalist. And so I kind of thought this 2021 board was going to be my best shot. And I'm certain that it was. And I had a friend named Brick, who was the commander of the Thunderbirds at the time, who asked me to come over and take a look at his squadron and look at taking over for him, because he was in a bit of a reform. And I said, absolutely not. I've got a plan. You know, I'm done with squadron command. I don't want to do that again. That was hard. And no, all kidding aside, you know, I had a vector, but to his credit, he brought me over and he read me into everything he was trying to change in the squadron. Very, very good, believable changes. And I was hooked. And, you know, for me, I started to realize that NASA was going to be just fine. They had 18,000 applicants, you know, the best human beings on planet Earth were applying to that program, and they were going to be just fine. But this reform that Brick was putting the Thunderbirds through, it needed the right person at the right time. And if he thought it was me, and if our 4-star General Kelly at the time thought it was me, then how can you put your own life dream over the needs of an institution that you've served for 18 years? So it was the hardest decision of my life, and a decision I made on the flight line in front of, this is kind of funny, astronaut Mark Kelly, who was a senator and was learning about the F-35, and General Mark Kelly, who was the 4-star general in charge of Air Combat Command. No kidding, both of them on the flight line at the same time, 2 different Mark Kellys with 2 very different vectors that looked like 20 years in the future if everything went perfectly. And it was a really tough call, but when General Kelly asked me to take the team, I knew what I had to do. And so I withdrew from that NASA board and took command of the Thunderbirds.
That is so, so amazing. And for anyone out there, I mean, all you have to do is open up Netflix and just begin to type in Air Force, and it'll immediately bring you to Air Force Elite Thunderbirds. And you are in that documentary. And it's just a great way for everyone to follow up on your past. And I want to point something out here that you're probably too humble to mention yourself, and that is, you are the only person, if I understand correctly, who has all 3 elite Air Force programs on your resume of weapons school, test pilot, and Thunderbirds. Is that true?
That is true, Jeff. That is true. Yes.
Well, that is just even more amazing for what you've accomplished. And I want to transition from that to what we're certainly here tonight to talk about, and that is to talk about NORAD. So tell me a little bit about what brought you there, and then let's set a baseline, because we're going to talk about TFRs, we're going to talk about things for pilots operating inside and outside the United States. But at the same time, I think the folks that have heard the word NORAD and think about that don't even think about inside the United States. So tell me how you got there and give me a little bit of a baseline on NORAD.
Now, that's a really good set of questions. And I would say, actually, most people, when they hear the word NORAD, they think about tracking Santa Claus, which is a super important
part. That's that, but we usually have you guys on December, so we're doing it now because people are messing up now. But we'll
put it important, Jeff. It's that important. So the other 364 days of the year, you know, NORAD was founded in 1958. And if you think about the foundation of NORAD, it was to defend the continent, not just the country, but the continent against world-ending events. So, you know, we're talking about incursions into our airspace from Russian bombers, or from now Chinese bombers have started to approach it as well. You have the nuclear missile threat, of course, that stands over us every day. You have Golden Dome development going on our side to try to defend against that threat. And I think those things are fairly well known, but it is important to remember that NORAD is a binational command. We don't do this by ourselves. It is Canada and the United States combined, because Canada has an enormous part of North America to include the Arctic, which is where a lot of those threats come from. And so that reach is critical, and that truly integrated binational relationship is what makes NORAD successful. From a structural perspective, you know, we have a American four-star combatant command general in charge of it, and then a Canadian deputy commander right underneath him, a three-star, and then so on down the chain it goes. And it is truly interwoven, working in one building together. Okay, so that's how NORAD started, right? And that was our foundational principle for existing, was defending this continent against threats from the outside. And then September 11th happened, 2001. And, you know, for me, as an aside, that was my first day of ROTC. So it was kind of an eye-opening experience. And when September 11th occurred, you know, for us in NORAD, that was a shaping experience, because we realized for the first time that there was a very legitimate threat from within our own borders. The wrong people, violent extremist organizations, were able to take command of one of the aircraft within the United States or Canada, then they could use that aircraft as a weapon. And out of that was born Operation Noble Eagle, which was this concept of using our fighters scattered across Canada and the United States to rapidly launch to defend against protected pieces of our airspace from within, even against threats that we would not typically consider to be threats prior to 9/11.
That makes sense. I'm gonna bring up just a couple of images here really quick, just to kind of show what I think a lot of people kind of think of when they think of the, you know, the original side of NORAD, right? Which is like distant early warning and the command center that you have there. Tell me a little bit about what, you know, where you're located. And again, a lot of people don't necessarily realize the fundamental thing that you just said, which is this is a continent defense. And it's so well integrated as far as the United States and Canada.
Totally. And so our headquarters is in Colorado Springs. And the best way to remember that for everybody is Cheyenne Mountain is a pretty iconic landmark in, in North American history. It is right there on the screen. That's our nuclear attack proof mountain that we can seal up when we need to and operate fully from inside of it. To continue to defend this continent and coordinate that defense from within that mountain. Now, right next to it is Peterson Space Force Base. It's about a 25-minute drive, and that's where we are most of the time. So day-to-day, we tend to operate out of Peterson, but we do keep the mountain very much alive, and we do move back and forth between the mountain where we have our alternate command center to make sure that both of those are fully operational in case anything goes wrong that drives us into the mountain. So the mountain is very real. It's funny because I've heard rumors that the mountain was shut down in 2008, and that's absolutely not true. So I've been in it many times, and it's where we in fact do our mission qualification training when we first learn how to operate that command floor. So we know both sides of it.
Now, so it's still very real.
Very real. And while that's headquarters, you know, we have regions as well. So NORAD is huge. It's enormous. And so we have a three-star general in charge of Alaska that works just incursions from Alaska because it is so close in proximity to Russia. And then we have a Canadian general officer who runs the Canadian region, up to the north, all the way up to the Arctic, and significant responsibility looking north, which most people don't realize. We tend to think of the world in east-west, but a lot of the threats come from the north, which is why Canada plays such an important role. And then, of course, the continental United States has a region as well, where we defend mostly the internal part and then look for threats from the east and west as well. All
So
integrated.
let's start sort of inward and then work our way outward, where we start getting into kind of like, national current events and things like that, where people think of NORAD. But you mentioned that like so much of the mission changed after 9/11 and the idea of looking inward. Tell me a little bit about the evolution of temporary flight restrictions, TFRs, and I think a lot of people I've talked to don't even realize that that coordination is NORAD. I mean, that doesn't even track for people.
Yeah, so it's a great question. And I think the number one word that I would give you for post 9/11 NORAD equities is integration. This didn't just happen and we did not do this by ourselves. In fact, we probably weren't even the primary driver of this. We knew we had to defend certain pieces of airspace against domestic and international threats. How to do that? Well, that took a lot of coordination with NTSB, with the FAA, with TSA. To make sure that we had the authorities to operate our fighter jets in pieces of airspace that we were in fact there to defend. And so we have fighters spread across the continent, both in Canada and the United States, and they integrate very seamlessly to fly to defend those temporary flight restrictions that we need to defend for certain moments. And let me just be clear for the crowd here, not every TFR is defended by NORAD fighters. And TFRs are still put up and owned by the FAA. It's their responsibility to police and monitor that airspace. But the ones we do need to defend are the really important ones. For example, the Special Flight Rules area, or the SFRA, as we call it, that 30-mile ring around Washington, D.C., where the president is most of the time, that is permanently defended by NORAD fighters 24/7. And not just from fighters, but also from Coast Guard rotary wing assets that can fly slow alongside any violating aircraft, and also surface-to-air missile sites that we've got around the city. So that one I think is obvious. I think most people know that as a defended, very, very tough area to navigate without knowing what you're doing. And that one usually goes okay. Now, the president travels. And anytime the president travels, we put up a 30-mile ring around the president. And sometimes that's in an airspace with a whole lot of general aviation in the area, like Mar-a-Lago, for example, which is down in Florida. And likewise, the president will also occasionally travel up to Bedminster, New Jersey, which that 30-mile ring touches all the airports you've heard of, in that very difficult to navigate New York area. And that creates a whole lot of challenges. But the president can go anywhere. You can also take these national special security events like the UN General Assembly coming up and World Cup soccer and these major events where you're gonna have large gatherings of people, where somebody could make a statement by doing the wrong thing with an aircraft, and those we will defend as well. So it's a complicated, integrated function where the FAA and everybody is involved, really, and constantly communicating. By the way, our operations center has something called the DEN, where we are listening at all times to the FAA and TSA traffic, and we're kind of talking to each other and talking about people who may be an issue, or people who are not squawking, or people who have squawked Nordo accidentally. That's a big one for us that gets our attention quickly. And when that starts to happen, we're paying attention. And if it looks like you're going to go into our TFR, we're going to scramble fighters.
Wow. And so clearly there's a big difference then when you talk about a presidential TFR, as you mentioned here, versus a sporting event versus something like Oshkosh, right? Where everybody's flying into that. That's a TFR. And yet that seems more about traffic control than it
Exactly.
does about something else. So who are the players that then make that up? NORAD, as you mentioned already, is for the key and the most sensitive ones.
That's right.
Who's covering these other things like a ball game?
So those are covered by, if it's an air show TFR, then that's going to be the air boss that owns that with an FAA representative that's there on the ground with them. If it's a major sporting event, that's going to be an FAA policed TFR. And for those, there's still risk there. You don't want to punch into those because you could lose your license or worse. But the NORAD TFRs are special because they are enforced with armed fighter jets. And we take it very seriously because if you put yourself in General Guillaume's perspective as the four-star in charge of defense of North America, he can't take the risk of not being there and ready to act if something does turn nefarious. Now, certainly most of our TFR violators are not trying to do anything wrong. They just failed to check their NOTAMs or failed to visualize their NOTAMs and where they were going, or failed to get flight following or fly with something like ForeFlight to keep that situational awareness current. So normally it's an intercept and we turn you away. And as long as you follow our wing rock and our ICAO rules and let us lead you out of the TFR and back to safety, then it's not going to be the end of the world. But we have to be ready for that ultimate situation where we're on the phone with the chain of command all the way up to the White House to make a really tough 9/11 style decision. We have to
Yeah.
be in position in case it happens.
Let's talk a little bit about the kind of like the process that you recommend for everyone that they should be following. And obviously you've mentioned ForeFlight. There's many different electronic flight bags. There's obviously any software that someone's using for mapping, most of it should have that. But I guess it all starts with the planning for your flight.
Exactly.
And so let's talk a little bit about one of, I think, the most ignored things in general aviation, right? Which is the NOTAM.
That's right. That's right. And notice this, Darman. I mean, I know this, your show has a lot of pilots on it, so this is not a term that we have not heard. But whether we read everything in the text or take the time to visualize it on a map is a very different thing. I think most pilots, and that includes really experienced fighter pilots, have that temptation to look at the NOTAMs at our destination to make sure there's not a crane on the runway or something that's going to stop me from landing where I'm trying to go. I think we're decent at checking NOTAMs on our departure airfield to, and maybe even some of our primary diverts. What'll get you though is that these are 30-mile TFRs, and when they pop up, sometimes it's with pretty little notice. We try to be ahead of the curve and get that out as soon as we can, but we don't decide when the president travels. And when the president travels, that TFR is going up, sometimes with very little notice. And so what I find is instead of reading the text-based NOTAMs throughout my entire route of flight, that is very difficult for me to process. Maybe I have a small brain, but I find it hard to turn text into visualization. I think the graphic visualizations of these NOTAMs is critical. So I try to look at TFRs on a map to the max extent possible. And I look at my black line and my diverts and I go, am I going there? And if you're going to New York anytime in the next 3.5 years, you should look because there's a very good chance that the president has decided to go to Bedminster or New York and that TFR is going to be up. Same with Florida. For Florida pilots, Mar-a-Lago, it's a big one and it's a big TFR and we do police it. So
And
it's
as you
important to
mentioned,
visualize.
it can be for all sorts of things, and that includes forest fire, police activity. There's a whole lot of things, it seems, that cause very last minute updates to TFRs. And as you mentioned, I mean, if you're planning a trip and you try to read the text for it, well, you've got FDC NOTAMs, you've got things there that, like you said, you'll be reading about a crane or a tower that is going to be 3,000 feet below you, and you may miss that. What? So you mentioned graphics is the key. I think the other thing is about getting the latest data.
That's right.
But even that only gets you so far, right? I mean, if you're doing, I just got back from flying down to South Carolina. You're going to do a trip like that. The chances, it's quite possible during a 6-hour flight that life changes along the way.
Yes.
Tell me a little bit about coordinating how you can protect yourself by coordinating with something that you may not legally have to do, like flight following, versus or monitoring guard, but that'll help you.
Oh, 100%. I think, a couple things. One, when you're looking at that visualization, especially when you're talking about electronic flight books, a lot of times those TFRs will be yellow when they're not active but are about to be. I want you to read that as a warning and think that, hey, maybe, just maybe, this thing's going to be red when I show up. And then look for that to turn red if you have it live. The live data, you can't beat it. But to your point, Jeff, a lot of our TFR violations start with somebody who has entered a TFR, VFR, squawking 1200, and just wasn't aware that they were there. Well, when you do that, the response is the same. We don't care why you're there. We need to find out why you're there. And so you are about to get the entire chain of command on the phone on a Noble Eagle conference to talk about you. And then we're going to scramble fighters. And a few minutes later, you're going to have F-16s, 15s, F-18s from Canada, F-35s. Anything that we can throw at you in the area is going to be sitting on your wing, which is not a good thing for your pilot's license. Not a good thing for your sanity. And so we in the Air Force, we're pretty good pilots, but we still believe in flying IFR or with flight following to the max extent possible. Because it does give you that second look, that real time over the shoulder controller to help you. And they're not trying to hurt you. They're there to help you get where you're trying to go legally. And have a squawking when you're on the right frequency and when you're talking to the controllers in the area, you're not going to hear from us. But it's when you go Nordo or stop talking or you're on the wrong frequency or you're squawking 1200 and you blitz through one of those TFRs, we're going to be there. So highly encourage it, especially in these areas where the TFRs can pop up. Get flight following. Use the help that we've got to get
So
you where you need.
in IFR, obviously you're the responsibility for your navigation and airspace control is with the controller. In VFR, it's advisory, right? And so theoretically, the responsibility is still on the pilot. But at the same time, if I'm hearing you correctly, you've got your best chance, first of all, of them warning you that you've strayed into, I mean, the larger 30-mile ring, you're talking to them, you're fine. But the smaller rings that you're supposed to stay out of no matter what, they could be busy and not notice that you were doing something you weren't supposed to do. But my understanding is then that when you hop on that Noble Eagle call and you start coordinating pretty quickly, someone, if that situation arrived, is going to go, I know exactly who that is. I've already been working him. We've just called him and told him he needs to turn around or whatever. That's it makes, in other words, it makes a big difference, even if it isn't a legally absolving you of where you're going.
That's right. If you're on flight following, you have the free will to fly into our TFRs anyway, despite what the controller is going to try to do to convince you not to. But the situation can end very differently if we know who you are and where you were trying to go, and it looks like an innocent situation versus one where you're pointing straight at the center of it and descending and accelerating. That's going to get our attention real fast.
Yeah. So you've as if I as I understand it, your organization and you personally have been part of a tour going around to different air shows, including Oshkosh and others. I have seen the demonstrations of an intercept that you have done, which are impressive to say the least. Not impressive in a way that I want to be on the receiving end, but I'm fine seeing that air show from the ground. But give me some guidelines. Of what pilots should know. They're going to play. We're assuming that anyone who's watching the show right now and is listening cares about TFRs. They want to do the right thing. And yet, we all make mistakes. Hopefully, not this mistake. But give me some guidelines here.
Right. So the first thing to know is that if a fighter jet pulls up on your wing, we are not there to fly an air show for you or to say hello or to just tell you, hey, great job, flying today. We are there because we've been scrambled and we are intercepting you because you're doing something wrong. And I think just that mentality alone will help you process what's going on and make the right decisions. So when our pilots intercept you, we are not looking to shoot you down right away. In fact, for your awareness, you're going to see one of our fighters. The other one is behind you in a weapons engagement zone. And that's important because usually the aircraft we intercept are slow moving. It's very hard to stay on the wing. So you've got one fighter that's going to rejoin with you. They're going to look inside your cockpit. We're going to look for situations like, hey, did you fall asleep at the wheel? Are you alive? Is there something shady going on, like windshields pulled down and clearly trying to ignore the jet sitting right next to you? So we're looking for those kind of initial emotional intelligence vibes of, is this guy lost or is this guy trying to do something bad? The next thing you're going to see out of that fighter jet is a wing rock, which is the standard symbol for follow me. And that's exactly what we want you to do. We want you to follow that wing rock. He's gonna rock his wings several times, and then he's gonna pull away. And we want you to calmly follow that aircraft and then bring up guard. So you know the guard frequencies. That's what we're looking for you to monitor. Should be obviously pilots should be on them at all times.
121.5. That's what you're talking about for everybody.
Yeah, and if you're in a jet with UHF 2430, but monitor that because we're probably trying to talk to you. We're not just gonna blindly rock our wings and expect you to comply. But whether you get it visually or audio or your Nordo, if a fighter jet walks his ring, rocks his wings and pulls away, follow that airplane. They're going to take you outside the TFR. Okay, the next thing that's going to happen if you don't comply is you're going to see that jet again. And this time that jet is going to do what's called a headbutt, which is going to be a wing rock again, but this time they're going to fly across your nose with burner and sometimes flares and anything they can do to get your attention. Because now we're telling you, hey, you have ignored a fighter, and that is not good. So that headbutt is meant to get your attention, even if you're somehow completely missed the airplane off your wing. It's going to fly right in front of you. Same thing. Follow that jet. That is what we want you to do so we can take you out of that TFR. At that point, we're going to shadow you until you land. We're going to make sure that you don't try to take back off again. We're going to have you get out of your aircraft, and you're likely to be met by law enforcement on the ground. And most of the time at that point, we turn it over to the FAA, who deals with licensing issues, brashers. But if it's nefarious, then you may deal with law enforcement outside the FAA. Again, that's not our jurisdiction. We're there to get you out of that TFR, or deal with it with force if necessary.
Wow, that certainly makes sense. And you were it did not go unnoticed that you said we're not there to shoot you down right away.
Not trying to scare anybody. It's just that 9/11 did happen, right? And so the authority, just to be clear, lies well above that pilot's level. Like those pilots are not there to, make their own decision and pull the trigger. That Noble Eagle Conference is very, very high up in government to make a decision like that. And the rules are different for each type of violation. A derelict object, I don't know if that term means anything to the general audience, but derelict object is someone who is no longer flying the aircraft. So maybe they've died. It's happened. Maybe they're asleep, not in control, and the aircraft is on autopilot. That has a certain level of authorities, and it's still, if it flies through a TFR, we're going to intercept it.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. The other thing I want to get your thoughts on and adding is the idea that any pilot that's got two radios and the ability to monitor a second radio, I've always been taught, why not have that on guard? Why not have that radio on 121.5 or 243 if you're a jet at all times? What are your thoughts on that?
For what it's worth, even Air Force fighters that police these TFRs and that own the airspace they're in, we monitor guard at all times. So our in fact our radios are programmed to, I can change frequencies and they still have guard monitored in the back of that radio. So even if I have multiple radios, one is always monitoring guard. And I know it's noise, right? I know that sometimes people talk on guard and that's tough to listen through, and we have a button in our cockpits that you can silence it for a temporary amount of time, but it stays monitored and it comes back by default. So yeah, as a general aviation pilot, I would monitor guard if at all possible.
Well, one of the other things that I think is beneficial about doing that is you can actually help. There are many circumstances where someone can't be reached, or they went out of a zone, out of a radar or an approach or a center control, and they weren't handed off, or they didn't hear a handoff, or something else happened. And it just gives you an opportunity that sometimes people need a relay. There's ways you can even help as a bystander in that case.
100%. And I think we talk about the defense part of NORAD so much that I think it's worth saying that we will also show up to help. If we see something wrong, and we're in a position to help, we're going to fly next to you to try to assist. So it needs to be a cooperative community. I think 99.999% of us as pilots are all trying to do the right thing, trying to get where we're trying to go, defend what we need to defend, and execute the mission that we took off for. And if you monitor guard like you're talking about, Jeff, we can all just help each other out, and that's just a better aviation community for the whole country and for both countries.
Lastly, on the topic of TFRs, can you give me some insight about what's been actually happening lately? Are you essentially kind of like sending this message because things are not getting better? Is that really the bottom line here?
Yeah, it goes in waves, and I think one of those waves is driven by having a new presidential administration, right? Like President Biden went to different places for his alternate locations than President Trump does. President Trump is, now he's back in office. He visits Florida often. He visits Bedminster, New York area often. And so you have aviation communities that for the last 4 years have not seen a lot of presidential TFRs, and now suddenly they are seeing presidential TFRs again. And so we tend to see that surge when we have a new administration and new areas where we pop those TFRs up. And so it's this message we will have to continue to convey it as time goes on, depending on what's going on between the two countries. There are times when we're going to drop a TFR with very little notice, but the message has to continue to get out there that if you check your NOTAMs, and especially if you visually check them and follow flight following to the max extent possible, it'll keep you out of trouble. But no, it's not a nefarious surge. It's just that we're in new areas right now.
So basically every time that you get this kind of concentration with any administration of where they tend to go and you get that changeover, you're going to get some teething pains
Exactly.
on people, especially if it happens to overlap with high traffic general aviation areas.
Exactly. Exactly. And it's
So
not always as obvious as the new administration, right? So like during 2024, we had the Democratic National Conventions, the Republican National Conventions, and you had a lot of travel from national leadership that we needed to defend. And so that hit a lot of areas that you wouldn't expect. So there's always something, and we need to continue to get the message out.
That certainly makes sense. I want to talk for just a minute about kind of national events and what's happening externally. And really kind of on two different topics. One, I think that's important to point out from knowing personally, me knowing all of you at NORAD, that what happens, it seems to me, what happens politically in the world where you start hearing about tensions between Canada and the United States, it just doesn't seem to permeate your organization and the way that life actually works and the way we work together. Can you talk about that for a second?
Yeah, I think this is an organization that is incredibly professional and incredibly mature. And I don't just mean that at the personal level. I mean the organization is mature. Since 1958, we've been working Canada and the United States like this. That isn't going to change with a political administration on either side. We're going to have political disagreements, but as those of you who are familiar with the military know, our job, our charter is to be apolitical. A military officer is going to serve through multiple administrations, it's going to be back and forth, and our job is to stay rigidly professional and execute the mission to empower our politicians to make decisions. And that has not changed. It will not change. And the Canadians are the same way. They're amazing people. We work hand in hand every day and really respect each other. We have to.
Well, one thing that definitely does change is international relations
Right.
outside of the United States and Canada and NORAD. And it's really been fascinating in this basically this partnership that we've had in having NORAD here on the show for 5 years running, seeing things like the news when the pandemic hit and being very open about what was happening with incursions and sort of kind of probing and what was happening for activity at that time having to do with force readiness. We're seeing a lot in the media right now about Russia, some about China, and especially up around Alaska. And as you mentioned earlier in the show, if you really look at a globe, it's not east and west, it's the north that we're closest to an awful lot of adversarial countries. Tell me what NORAD's been responding to and what people how people can understand when they read something recently in the news about, for example, Russian jets, Chinese jets, and United States airspace.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the first, as an interesting exercise for everybody, if you want to understand our world, go onto Google Earth or Google Maps and turn the globe to the north, where you're looking straight down on the North Pole. That is how we see the world in NORAD. That's what our maps look like across the headquarters, and for very good reason. Because if you look at where the Russian bases are located, for example, they can reach Alaska in the Aleutians like instantly, with very little notice. They can have a bomber over the Aleutian Islands. Very similarly, they can fly across the North Pole and be in Canada's defense area very quickly. And then they can turn, what from a side view looks like a million miles and an insurmountable distance, but they can turn to the right and be in Alaska's airspace again with very short notice. So the geography of this whole thing is fascinating, and it forces us to be pretty creative with forward basing. You'll hear Greenland in the news, and that's because there's a very, very northern point in Pituffik, Greenland, that enables us to reach pretty close to the North Pole. So it's an important location. Canada has a lot of early warning radars, and I'll answer your question more directly, because what you do see in the news is a lot more mention of this now. It's been there though. The Russians test our defenses all the time. We respond constantly. We don't let any Russian ADIZ incursion, which is air defense identification zone. Think of this as a buffer zone between our land and where we are going to go intercept you to see what your intentions are. And they're pretty good buffers. Anytime a Russian or a Chinese aircraft or really any foreign government flies into that airspace, we are going to meet you with at least electronic custody, which is where we're going to make sure that we are locked onto you and are able to launch fighters if necessary. And most of the time, if it's anywhere within reach of our fighters, we'll be right there on your wing, taking pictures and making sure that you're not doing anything irreversible. And it happens a lot, and it's been happening, I think, for all of NORAD's history. What is relatively new is the what we call the combined bomber patrols between the Chinese Communist Party and the Russian Federation. And they, for the first time about a year ago, flew together and flew into the Alaskan ADIZ. And that certainly got our attention. But what I'd say to all of our listeners is, while they are just now becoming cooperative, where they're able to talk to each other and fly loosely together, the United States and Canada has been completely integrated since 1958. It's not a novelty for us to fly with Canadian fighters. It's one central command and control headquarters seamlessly integrating across both continents, and I would put that up against anything in the world for capability.
How do you, I know there's no simple answer to this, but it's the obvious question, I think, to anyone who's on my side, right, of this, the outside of NORAD. It looks on a map to be such a small distance between an ADIZ and our sovereign, airspace, key cities, things like that. And yet, as on one hand, you've mentioned, hey, since the 50s, like this has just been standard practice. You go up, you do this, you see if there's a response. And we play these games. How on earth do you know the difference between what is a traditional, regular kind of like, intercept and something that it would seem in minutes can go way, way past that? And
Right.
then how on earth do you respond to it?
Right. Anything in aviation, as all of you pilots know, happens fast. And so it's a challenge on resources because we have to be ready to react every single minute of every single day from any coastal incursion across the continent. That's a big ask, right? The reason NORAD is a binational command is because it has to be, because that demand to be ready with minutes notice will always be there. And to answer your question, we are just constantly monitoring with a combination of early warning radars with overhead capabilities in space and with our own fighter and electronic custody airborne control patrols to make sure that we are in a position to defend, right? Like the intercepts are great, but we're not always going to go make that physical intercept, but we will always be in a blocking position in case something turns nefarious.
I
I
guess
think
that's the real key, right? Is that you mentioned earlier when we're talking about TFRs and you are essentially saying for the really important ones, for the presidential TFRs or key events there, that you're going to, that the general in charge of NORAD is going to, his job is to make sure one doesn't get through.
Right.
Is that the same approach to you know, Seattle or Anchorage or any of these other American cities, that that the process that you have there, and when we hear about these things, that all of a sudden someone makes a 90 degree turn and things go different, that the goal is they can't actually get accomplish the mission?
That is exactly right. Think of it as a defensive blocking position, and certainly there are places that we know are juicier targets, right, for a foreign government that, that is trying to make a statement, major cities, defense critical infrastructure. We are always in a position to defend those immediately, but we are truly putting ourselves in a position to defend every U.S. and Canadian citizen against nefarious actors. And, you know, not every piece of land has a city on it. So there are areas that provide a bit of a buffer.
You're trying to tell some fishermen up there that there's some cushion zones that they're not totally covered.
If the Russians decide to expend their nuclear cruise missiles on fishermen, then that's going to be a tough one to defend against. But we're going to try. You know, but you get the idea. You know, it's prioritized defense, of course, but it is also looking at the whole picture. And we try to be there before you can threaten any of our citizens across both countries.
Got it. Well, Colonel Elliott, we're basically come to the top of the hour, but I do want to take some time, if you are game, to do something we call Social Flight's Fast Five, to get a little bit of personal, quick kind of questions from you. Are you game for that? You got a little extra time for it?
Let's do it.
All right. All right, Colonel Justin Astro Elliott from NORAD. This is your Social Flight Fast Five, five questions to get to know you just a little bit better. And you have, as we mentioned earlier, a absolutely unbelievable history, track record, resume of aircraft going all the way from, you know, all the different aircraft, F-35, A-10, F-15s, F-16, all the way up, flying for the Thunderbirds, you name it. Out of all of that flying, is there one of those planes, I mean, even the A-10s in your history, is there one of those that just you sit there and if you had a choice and could go out on the flight line right now, would be the bird you'd choose?
Okay. Combat F-35, Joyride F-15. It was just the last jet we made with no compromise and just pure aerodynamics and power. And it was just a beautiful airplane to fly. The most interesting plane though is the Super Guppy that I flew in test pilot school, the one that can't roll more than 30 degrees without tipping over and lands on its nose wheel. So it's a pretty diverse.
You flew the Super Guppy? I didn't know that.
I flew the Super Guppy, and it is just amazing. For those who don't know, it's a B-29 modified, you know, with a giant top to carry rockets around, and it was instrumental in winning the space race back in the day because we could move faster than trains. But man, it's a terrible airplane. You know, for a flight it was not designed to be good to fly.
And I didn't even know. You just gave me a new nugget. It lands on its nose wheel.
It does. It lands on its nose gear, and you have like a throttle DJ behind you while you're flying, because you're so focused on just not overbanking that you have an engineer that's like, you know, you tell him, hey, set thrust to 8, and he sets thrust to 8. Whatever happens back there is up to him. It's wild. Really interesting flight experience.
Very cool. And I will say, I'm sorry, but you're not alone in saying the F-15 is the joyride. That seems to be what everyone wanted as their choice if they were top of their class.
It's awesome.
Fantastic. All right. Question number two, during all of that flying, was there a particularly scary or impactful or moment in your life or your flying that that you feel kind of gave you a lesson that you take to this day?
Yes. Flying over Kop Keating in an F-15E in Afghanistan in 2009. There's a book called Red Platoon. You can read about this, but it was a really difficult combat situation. And as I was on approach to release weapons to defend our guys down there, I had a hydraulic failure in the F-15E that took out my landing gear, my brakes, my speed brakes, my ability to refuel, and my radar, both air-to-air and air-to-ground, so the targeting systems. And the F-15E is a two-crew cockpit, so I had Mule Keeley in the back seat, and I just remember within a second having to make a decision on whether we release multiple JDAMs and to go through the systems in my mind of, are these still targeted? Are they going to go to the right place, or are they going to possibly go to friendlies? And to kind of do that systems analysis live within a 1 second window of weapons release. And I just remember to this day, Mule from the back just going, "You good?" And I was like, "Yep." And we had both done that analysis and we released weapons successfully and then made an emergency landing back at Bagram. And that was a shaping experience for me, because it's funny how when you're in that moment, the last thing you're thinking about is yourself and your own safety, despite the obvious reasons that you should be. You're thinking about the people on the ground. And it was a really good reminder in my career that this is not about me. It's about the guys fighting on the ground and whoever's in the most danger in that specific moment. And, you know, that's that service element of Air Force flying that is inextricable from the joy of flying for your country.
Wow. And you mentioned how people can look into that story.
Red Platoon. There's a book called Red Platoon that that talks about it, and it is rightfully so focused on the ground battle, as it should be. And it does mention that situation in one of the chapters, but it's just a harrowing story for the guys that were fighting on the ground.
Wow. Well, that is very, very powerful. And I'll turn things just a little bit with question number three for you. And that is, if you had a moment of your flying history that you could go back to re-experience, not to change it, just because it was so special that if you just had a chance to go back in that seat for 10, 15 minutes, you would. Where would you put yourself?
Okay. All right. Chicago Air and Water Show as Thunderbird 1 in 2023. It was, I had this moment in the Delta role where I was like, wow, like, you know, it's near the end of the season. It was my second year. It was the 70th anniversary of the Thunderbirds. The show had millions of people on the beach, literally, really enthusiastic crowd, and we were so good. You know, I'm willing to say that my 2023 team was so good. It was just an unbelievably surreal moment to be leading the Thunderbirds on the 70th anniversary over millions of people, and to be performing well on a good weather day. I'd do it again in a heartbeat.
Oh, that's wonderful. I love that. All right, question number four. If you could go back in time to that young Justin Elliott, back in your teens or your 20s, and give a little piece of advice, what would you say?
Simple. I would tell you that there is no guarantee that by taking risks and putting yourself out there and chasing your dreams that it's all going to work out for you. But there's a 100% guarantee that if you don't take risks and chase your dreams and put in the work, that it will not work out for you. So I'd say take risks and chase your goals, because it at least gives you a chance.
I love that. That's fantastic. All right. And our last question in Social Flight's Fast Five for you. If you could choose anyone from history or current, no longer with us or here with us today, anyone at all to spend an evening with, who comes to mind?
Okay, this one's going to surprise you. Matt Heafy from Trivium. He's the front man for a band called Trivium. And his music blows my mind. It's my kids' favorite thing in the world. They're young aspiring musicians. So I would go to dinner with Matt Heafy to talk about his music, and I'd bring my little guys along to learn from him.
That's fantastic. That's perfect. Absolutely love it. And you're the only one's going to get a question number six ever on this. And here's your question here. Is there still a chance we get you at NASA?
No, there is not. there's not. No, realistically, I think, you know, the chief astronaut told us that they're really looking for longevity right now, rightfully so, as they go into Artemis. And so you don't want an 06 that's, you know, that in a colonel position in a combatant command. That's not what they're looking for. And that's okay. You know, that's okay. Like I said earlier, they are fine. They have the best people in the world applying every 4 years for those few slots. They're going to continue to be that amazing inspiration for humanity that hooks people like me and gets us to chase our goals. And whether or not we land on them, it's still a great life. And so I love those guys for what they do. Know a lot of them, respect them deeply. But unfortunately, my time has passed.
Well, Colonel Justin Elliott, thank you so much for everything that you've done for our country, for helping, as you mentioned, with that massive change with the Thunderbirds, with what you're doing for NORAD, and for helping teach the rest of us a little bit more about TFRs and what we need to be paying attention to keep ourselves safe out here in the general aviation world. I really appreciate it, and I really appreciate the time you've taken out of your very, very busy schedule to join us here on Social Flight Live.
Well, thanks, Jeff. This was a real pleasure. You're a mind reader, and your questions are very deep, and I love that because I think it gets to the core of what we do. So thank you for taking the time to make this an amazing experience.
Well, coming from you, that means a lot. So have a wonderful evening, and I hope to see you and NORAD back on the show in the future.
Yes, sir. We'll see you.
All right. Take care.
Bye.
And to all of you, thank you so much for joining us here on Social Flight Live and for everything that you do to support general aviation. We'll be back next week, which is September 9th at 8 p.m. on our Cockpit to Cowl show with Brian Schiff. To register for that show, you just go to cockpit, the number 2, and the word cowl, cockpit2cowl.com. You can register for that. We're going to be talking about understanding Mosaic. There, understanding Mosaic on the next show. That's on Cockpit to Cowl on September 9th. And then on September 16th at 8 p.m., we're back here on Social Flight Live, and we have really, truly out of this world piloting going on, because we've got Havard Grip, the chief pilot of the Mars Ingenuity helicopter, here on the show, going to talk about what it's like to fly a helicopter on Mars. That's a new one here. And it's going to be a really, really great show here on Social Flight Live. So again, thank you so, so much for joining us tonight. And I wish you all blue skies.